Hello and welcome back to the 200th episode of the Long Distance Love Bombs podcast. Oh my goodness, it's still me, your host, Dr. Jeremy Goldberg, and this episode is a unique one. I basically sent my buddy Traver a text message and said, hey, let's do something random together. And in this conversation, you will hear all about it. It is off the cuff. It is spontaneous. It is intuitive. It's hilarious and silly, occasionally profound, quite deep. And I hope you enjoy it. We're trying something new to celebrate the 200th episode. And let me know what you think. Please do send me a message. If you want some more of these kinds of episodes, I can arrange that. If you hated it, I would like to know that also. But thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. I cannot believe that it's been 200 episodes. Very grateful and looking forward to more. So without further ado, here's me and my buddy Traver Bohm having a random show.
You'd have kept that part.
Yeah, just record it. Fuck it.
Yeah, fuck it. Let's do it.
We've done 2 minutes of conversation and planning for this.
Yeah.
And you were about to tell me some of your secrets. And I was like, no.
Yep.
Save those.
Well, this is probably the first time I've come to a podcast where someone's given me instructions.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's like an innate desire to not fuck this up. And then also the understanding that like it's impossible to fuck it up, but that's a really hard duality for me to hold as an East Coaster, you know?
As a high achiever.
As someone who grew up in Connecticut.
All right. Well, let me give you more context for what is happening here, because as background for those listening, I basically just sent Traver a text message and said, hey man, here's some things. Can you do those? And then we'll do a podcast. And he was like, yeah, that sounds great. But as backstory, there's a podcaster named Tim Ferriss, who is famous and renowned and huge, best-selling author. And he periodically does what he calls a random show with his buddy, Kevin Rose, who is a big shot technologist, entrepreneur. And they've been doing these for years, years and years. And they just get together and they drink wine or beer and shoot the shit. And they each bring to the table a couple of different items, ideas, trinkets, purchases, stuff they're thinking or reading about. And they just shoot the shit for a couple hours. And I thought, you know, that looks fun because I love listening to those conversations. They're spontaneous. They're hilarious. They're super fucking random, which is right up my alley. And Traver Bohm, this is my 200th podcast episode.
Really? First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
Do you know that the average podcast doesn't get past like 3 episodes? It's like some insane, like 90% don't make it past 21 episodes or something.
Really?
Yeah. You're elite.
We are elite.
We are. I mean, you could probably say like, hey, this is Jeremy Goldberg. This is my elite podcast.
Yeah. Goldberg. Long distance elite bombs.
Yeah.
But like actually that. On the Tim Ferriss line of thinking, he has this thing that I use when I started the podcast, which is essentially when you do something new, commit to doing, I think, 7 yeah. reps, classes, thing. So like if you sign up for a pottery class, like go 7 times. If you're going to do a podcast, make 7 episodes, because it's very easy to quit on the first or second one because you suck and it's hard and it's not fun. But if you do 7 or 9 or whatever his number is, then you actually know that you gave it a good shot.
Yeah.
So that's the idea. I think you've got a couple things to discuss. I've got a couple things to discuss. Some of mine are pretty random and fun. But stuff I love. And, but for someone listening, that's like, who's Traver Bohm? Who is this handsome, dapper, bald man that I'm looking at on YouTube right now? You've been on the podcast several times now. You're one of my closest friends. Do you want to give a little intro to yourself?
I am a multi-time long distance love bomb podcast guest professionally. That's what I do.
You bought this microphone.
That's
that I'm
right.
using.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Hi, everybody who doesn't know me. My name is Trevor Bohm. I run a men's movement called The Uncivilized. I'm trying to shift the paradigm of masculinity. That sounds big and scary. So I just like to talk to dudes about possible ways they can live differently and perhaps a little bit more holistically, combining like, you know, go out and get some shit done with don't forget to feel along the way. That's kind of the gist in it together.
Synergizing the divine and the primal.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys can see the perfectly placed branding behind me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is it? Like half a Buddhist statue and
half a gorilla.
And half a gorilla.
Yeah. I found a tattoo artist in LA, Jeremy, who I want to get that tattooed. You know, when I first had the branding done, I was like, oh, I'm going to get this tattooed. And my branding person was like, that is a sin in branding. Like no band gets their own band name. Like Motley Crue isn't running around with Motley Crue tattooed on them. She's like, don't do it. But here I am like 6 years later. And I was like, nah, I found a really great artist in LA who skews things. So it wouldn't be the exact branding, but yeah, I think I'm going to get that done.
Where are you going to put it on your body?
I'm going to put two. So one on each forearm, and it's going to be like the Buddha head emerging from in between like a split gorilla head, and then the gorilla head emerging from in between two Buddha head, like a split Buddha head, one on each forearm.
That's cool.
Yeah, thanks.
I think because Groves has his brand on his forearm, I think.
I think he's got the brain and the heart, yeah, on one side.
Yeah. So maybe I should just go get mine too.
I mean, it would behoove you probably. I mean, you're already in the elite category, but like eliter comes when you have
but I'm I'm a clean tattoo. Skin. I don't have any tattoos.
Yeah. Okay. I would say a chest piece. That's what I'd go for if I were you.
Just like a camel face or something super cool. Imagine. I got my first tattoo, Kendra. What is it? And I take my shirt off and it's just a giant camel on my entire front of my torso.
Please let me be there for that. Yeah, please let me be there for that.
Oh, man. All right. Well, we're off and running in a random way. Do you want to go first as the guest to share?
Fire away, man. Kick us off.
You want me to go?
Yeah.
All right. So my first one is library books.
And we're going that random.
Oh, bro, you know me.
Okay,
like,
okay. Let's hear about library books.
That random. You thought I would not go full random.
I was like, you know, like I'll talk about my jujitsu belt. Yeah. I like this.
Library books. So you can't see me, but behind my shoulder, there is a bookcase filled with books.
Okay.
And everywhere I've lived, I devour books. I'm a reader. I'm curious. I love books. I don't love the electronic books. I've never used those. I like holding the physical thing in my hand.
Do you listen to audiobooks?
No.
Really?
No. I never have.
Really?
Yeah, not one.
Okay. You're old. You're like a classic man.
I'm an old man. Yeah.
Like 1950s suit with a cigar and like a curly mustache. Yeah.
Okay. I want to smell the paper on my fingers when I'm done with that book.
I think I've told you, may I interrupt and tell and share a quick story?
Yeah.
You may have heard this before, but the very first time I hung out with my girlfriend three years ago or so, we went on this long hike and driving out to it was like 45 minutes. And she's like, so tell me something that not many people know about you. And I was like, oh man, what an opportunity to share something vulnerable and real and deep. And so for like 25 minutes, I told her about this condition I have where like the top of my bladder head or the bottom of my bladder head is really constricted. So for my whole life, it would take me sometimes like up to 3 minutes to urinate. I remember it being at a swim meet and a bunch of people were like, it's absurd. We're going to time you. And I drank like, you know, as much Gatorade as I could get into my system. And then a half an hour later, I'm like almost at the 3 minute mark peeing. and I had to almost have surgery, and there was like a orthoscopic, you know, like they shoved a camera up my urethra, yada, yada, yada. So I go on and on and on and on and on and on and on. It's the first time we've hung out. And I was like, yeah, wow. She's like, thanks. Thanks so much for sharing that with me. It's like, yeah, what about you? What's something a few people don't know about you? And she goes, I like the smell of new books. Like, ah, that's what you want to fucking share? I just told you my medical history. It was so sincere. So honest. Yeah, I might have fallen in love in that moment. Yeah. But please, you guys have a kindred, a kindred love of the smell of the page.
Let's we call do. It. I actually just sent her a text message like a half an hour ago saying simply, why would anybody put peanut butter in the refrigerator? Because I saw your Instagram story today.
Oh, I didn't know the conversation was going to get violent. Wow. This is okay.
I just full transparency. I was messaging your lady
behind my back.
Just about a very random topic. So it fits the theme. Yeah.
For a very sensitive and relational disturbing topic. Yeah.
Yeah. For those that didn't see though, you put the peanut butter in the refrigerator and she queried why you did that.
Yeah. I did that for a year and then we had a sit down and I was like, all right, I'll try it your way. And then, you know, it like drips on the counter and got all over the place. And so I solved that problem with my elite masculine brain and put it back in the fridge. And this morning it came up again and we're doing okay. We're trying to figure some things out of,
you're going to make it through.
Yeah. Someone actually messaged me on Instagram. Was like, it's time for a his and her peanut butter. Like his is in the fridge. Hers is in the cabinet. Yeah. And I don't know why, but Katie shut that down pretty hard.
That seems so reasonable.
That's probably why she shut it down pretty hard.
You can't be doing that.
But carry on.
Back to the library books. So I have owned and purchased hundreds, if not thousands of books in my life.
Yeah.
And you know, they're not cheap. You pay right. $20-$30 to pay for shipping. So there's like an environmental cost, etc. And we moved up here to Squamish and I joined the local library. I was finally kind of settled enough where I got my library card. Awesome. I felt like I joined this exclusive membership. Mm-hmm. And so I've not bought a book in so long. And I've noticed there's like two really good benefits directly that have happened to me that surprised me. One is you're on a deadline to finish the book. Like there's a due date. And so it's like, hey, you got 3 weeks or a month or whatever to finish this book. And they send you email reminders. And so consequently, like I read more, I read faster. It is more of a priority for me. Right. And then secondly, if I'm not loving the book, I just stop reading it because I don't feel obligated to finish it because I bought it and I want to get my money's worth. I feel like I've got the whole world at my fingertips. And it's like, I don't have time to read terrible books because I can get any of them in the next week or two. So like, why would I waste time on this one if I'm not loving it? You know?
Yeah. There's no, sunk cost fallacy.
No.
Right.
No. And it's fun, man. You get the email and it's like, hey, your book's ready to come pick it up. And it feels like fucking Christmas. And I go there and I was like, hi, I'm Jeremy Goldberg. And they go in the back and they bring it out. Doctor. Yeah. Reverend Jeremy Goldberg. And they hand me the book and it's just like, yeah, sweet.
Let me ask, what's the like punishment for not bringing it back on time?
Well, this is it. There is none.
They don't fine you?
There's no late fees.
There's not like a dime a day or something?
Nothing.
It's just the moral, like they know, you know, they know that you're not a good person.
And the punishment is you get a bunch of emails saying, hey. And so several times I have messaged the automated, you know, email and said, hey, I'm really sorry, but I do have the book. That's the good news. I haven't lost it. The bad news is I'm in Spain right now for another 3 weeks. And so then they email back and said, oh, don't worry. Like we checked it out for you again and we've extended your deadline. And anyway, I'm just dropping that as my first random idea for consideration.
I love it.
You support the local library. I've gone there and worked on my laptop. It's quiet. It's productive. Yep. I just like the idea of having more communities that have libraries. Mm. I think they're important. They often have really cool classes or programs for children, for people that want to get involved. Libraries. That's it.
I think they also, I don't know if this is still a thing, but when I used to work security, I liked audiobooks and I do like audiobooks. I used to read a ton of physical books, but now I've switched. But I could check out audiobooks from the library. Yes,
you can. Yeah. And there's a limited amount of those also.
Yeah.
Which I think
is. Do you think the constraint is helpful for you? Of like, yes, you can walk into a bookstore and get anything, but like, oh, the book you want's not ready. You have to wait 3 weeks. Is that good for you?
Yeah, it's exciting. And because where I live, the library is very small. And so what I have to do is what's called an interlibrary loan, where it goes out to their network of little libraries throughout the entire state or country or whatever. And then it like takes a while to get in. So it might take 2 to 4 weeks. And then I get my little alert and it's like, it's here.
Whoa.
And I get a little dopamine hit, a little rush. Mm. So there's a delayed gratification aspect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I like this.
It's red hot. I love it.
Right on, man. Right on. So thanks for sharing about the library. Yeah. I grew up going a ton, like going all the time. And I've told people, like, if you want to change your life, spend a year in a library card.
Yeah.
Free.
Or just traveling too. If you ever need good Wi-Fi, air conditioner, a quiet space, internationally, like go find a library, post up. Anyway,
for all you single guys, women over 60 seem to flock to the library. You know, if you're into, you know, that's your age bracket.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe you want to cut that out.
No, there's no. This is a random show. You're delivering. We have peanut butter, elderly dating tips.
Peanut butter.
What's your first one?
You know what I found, Jeremy? That this is speaking of waiting. So a year ago, I Googled this and it was like, oh, it's all over California. And I was like, cool. So I started calling stores asking about it and none of them had it. And the other day I was in Whole Foods and I walked to their non-alcoholic beer section because I don't drink, and they had non-alcoholic Guinness.
Yes.
And it tastes, I don't remember, like I kind of remember Guinness, but it's what I remember it tasting like. And so my journey with non-alcoholic beer first was like, nah, why even drink it? Right. But then there was that like Friday afternoon in the fall, and college football was on and it was chilly and I had a flannel and I was wearing big fluffy like slippers. And I was like, you know what would be amazing right now? A cold beer, but I don't drink. So I went finally and got a non-alcoholic beer and lived that fantasy. However, it tasted like warm, watered down kombucha. I was like, oh, you guys, this is the early days, you know? So I walked away from it and was like, I'd rather just drink a kombucha or sparkling water. But the other day I found non-alcoholic Guinness and I drank one and was like, this is delicious. And then there's only 4 in the pack. And then, so here's an interesting like thought experiment. Because it's non-alcoholic, I was like, I could drink 16 of these in a day. And I haven't done anything quote wrong, right? Like I can drink one for breakfast. I can wake up and crack a non-alcoholic Guinness and drink it in bed. And no one's going to be like, wow, you got a problem. But my brain is like, don't do that. That's what people with a problem do. So I've even had to like space them out where I'm like, I'll have one a week, you know, so I don't end up getting hooked. But then I'm like, hooked on what? You know, I'll drink 12 bubbly waters in a day. And I'm not like, man, I need to go to like BWA, you know? So yeah, I love them. I love them. I recommend for anybody, even if for people who do drink, if you're like, if you're not really drinking for the alcohol, but you're drinking for the, like, hey, I'm at a party. Hey, I like the ritual. Hey, it's Saturday and, you know, or Sunday and the Giants are about to lose again to the Cowboys, but I want something to consume while that happens. I highly recommend non-alcoholic Guinness. Oh, so far, the only place I've been able to find it is at Whole Foods, but that's okay.
I'm intrigued, man. That I haven't drank in a couple years either. And Guinness was my number one beer for a very long time. And you and I have a mutual friend who is now married to an Irishman. And this Irishman told me that it tastes like Guinness. And
the non-alcoholic.
Yes. Yeah. Really? He was like, it's not bad. It's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I've been on the search too. You can't find it.
It's hard, right? And then I went back to Whole Foods 2 days ago and was like, there was one other four pack and I grabbed it. And I don't know if it was the same four pack that I left a couple of weeks ago when I was like, I can't get eight of these. That's what someone with a problem would do. So I only got four, but now I'm working through. Yeah. What are your thoughts on like binge drinking non-alcoholic beer?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? I just picture the cashier. If you went and bought 20 non-alcoholic Guinness and you were drinking one in line for breakfast.
Yeah.
If there would be some judgment there. But I've experienced with this also because I've been just recently in the last few months having a non-alcoholic beer here and there. And what's been interesting is I would like click open the can. And I felt like there's these dormant parts of my brain that used to be hyperactive. Yeah. Like I hear the thing and my brain switches on and it's like, drink the whole beer right now. Or like, let's party or let's get going. I'm going to smash 10 of these. And I'm even as I'm sipping it, I feel like that part of my addictive primal past brain engage. And I'm aware of that engagement. And I'm a little bit uncomfortable with it. It's like, oh, dang, that rabid feral dog is still in my yard, even though he's been quiet for a long time.
Yeah, he's been asleep in the corner.
Yeah.
It's such a fascinating thing to play with, right? I remember the very first time after I quit drinking maybe 6 months prior, and I got invited to a bachelor party. And this was like the first like event where it was, you know, everybody there was going to be drinking and I was the only one. And the host reached out and said like, hey, everybody throw in your drink order. Like I'm going to do a big Costco run. Like, what do you guys drink? And I wrote him back and was like, hey man, first time doing this. I don't drink anymore. So I think I'll just be fine with like, you know, can you get me some sparkling water? And God bless them. He was like, totally cool. Not an issue at all. Would you like me to pick you up some NA beer? And I remember sitting with that for like 3 days. Being like, do I want to do that? Or is that like pretend? Is that going to make it easier on me than just showing up and being like, hey guys, I quit drinking 6 months ago. Like I'm still working with this. So I don't want to pretend that I'm part of the club, even though I'm not. And I told him eventually, he was like, no, actually don't. Please just get me some bubbly water. I'll be good. I didn't want the comfort of like holding it and not going through the discomfort of actually what I had to go through to be a non-drinker. And so it is kind of interesting to not wrestle with it, but I think the first time I got them, Jeremy, I drank two. Katie was out of town. There was football on. It was the ritual. And then after two, I was like, I can't do this again. Like I had some weird shame, like, uh-oh, this is a gateway product to, you know, and I wasn't an alcoholic. So it's not like, okay, I'm going to wake up next week in a gutter. You know, that's not the fear, but there was something about the softening the hard line. Maybe that's the best way to put it. It felt slightly incongruent. You know, it's like, I don't know if you've ever had dreams. Like after I quit drinking for the first year, I would like dream that I was drinking and people would come up to me in the dream and be like, hey, I thought you quit drinking. And I'd be like, oh shit, how did this happen? And it's super common for people who quit drinking or people who get sober. And I remember waking up and like, oh, thank God, thank God. And even thought like, what if someone in Whole Foods recognizes me? This is just the weird, and I'd have no issue with it. I wouldn't like run and hide and put it back and be like, yeah, look, non-alcoholic Guinness. But there's that like 3% of my brain that I think was very black and white with the decision that isn't quite comfortable with it.
Yeah, I relate to that. I'm reminded of years ago, one thing I started playing around with was this idea of like, if I want it, I can't have it. So like I'd get home from work. I'd be like, man, I really want to smoke some weed. And I'm like, oh, if I want to smoke weed, then like, I can't. Like, okay. I need a beer. It's like, oh, if I really, really want a beer, then there's something interesting there in that dynamic, and I'm not going to let myself have it. And so that was sort of what got me thinking about changing some of my behaviors and attitudes and things.
Yeah.
And then it was like, if I was sitting around, I was like, you know, like a beer sounds pretty good. Like, do I need it? Do I really, really want it? Or is it of the same energy or intention of like, you know, bubbly water would be nice. Or like, yeah, you know, maybe I'll have a piece of chocolate rather than this like heavily energetically necessary thing that I was, it wasn't about the beer or the weed, right? It was about the thing underneath it, the craving, the like urgency, the addiction. And I think for me, and maybe for you, some of that is being brought up by this non-alcoholic little action. It's like, oh, there's still maybe some stuff there, or but it hooks in me, you know, even though it's been dormant.
Yeah, I drank four of them over the course of a month, and was like, you know, it, and still was like, meh, do I want to? And would look at it next to, you know, a 12 pack of sparkling water, and be like, these are the same. Essentially, they're the same, right? And I've gone through the 12 pack in like 2 days, and again, not saying I have a bubbly water issue, but they're not the same. And so I think you're right. There's information in there. There is information. You know, a good thing Steve James does, Michaela's teaching assistant, he has like this rule of three with himself of like, oh, I want to check my phone. Like, okay, that's one. Sit with that. Let that disappear and wash out of you. And then five minutes later, it comes back like, oh, I want to check my phone again. It's like, cool, that's two. Let it wash out. And then the third time, I'll be like, okay, cool. Now let's actually consciously reach for the phone, look at it, do the thing, put it down. So maybe that's a piece people can play with.
Yeah, I like that. I know for me, it was like, it becomes habitual. You get home, put your bag down, take your shoes off. Maybe you walk over, sit on the couch, or maybe you just walk straight to the fridge. You grab a beer, you sit at the table, and there's your pipe and your weed sitting right there, but may as well, it's right there. Fuck it. Before you know it, I'm stoned. I'm drinking a beer. It's like 3 hours have gone by. What's happened to my life? At least
that's covered in mac and cheese. I'm naked.
Fried Doritos covered in chocolate glaze on my shirt.
Texting my ex from high school. Yeah. What happened?
Yeah. And I think for me too, I'm so cautious of going back to that place that was so hard to leave, that I'm so proud of leaving and so stoked and grateful where I am now, that any kind of slippery slope immediately puts my guard up. And it's like non-alcoholic beer. I'm like, hang on. I don't know if I fully trust myself. I need to explore this shit. What is going on in my body right now?
Yeah.
I'm going to keep an eye on this. Yeah. Versus bubbly water, I was like, oh, bro, bring the K again. Like, let's get a K.
Pour it down my throat. Yeah.
Get in my potty. well, this is going well. How do you think it's going, Trey?
Swimmingly. Elitely. Like someone who has 200 podcasts and is a doctor.
Yeah. Should I do my next one?
Sure.
So this one has a little bit of a story too. I think I've told this on here. I can't remember, but it's worth telling again. A couple years ago, Kendra Adachi, my girlfriend, got me a birthday present. And she bought me a knife, a bread knife. Because during the pandemic, like many others, I was looking for hobbies and distractions. And I learned how to make sourdough bread, which I know you eat now because Katie makes it.
There was a loaf made yesterday. We did paleo for like 2 months, and so there was no bread made in the house, and yesterday she made a loaf. So for breakfast today, I was like, I want to have my favorite breakfast: 4 eggs over easy, 3 pieces of bacon, 2 pieces of your sourdough bread. And I smashed it. Smashed it. Like, wipe the egg yolk off the plate with the bread. I mean, we're talking next level mouthgasms here.
Yeah.
Then I poured Guinness. I'm not.
I had 5 Guinness. But anyway, so I was making this bread for a while.
Yeah.
And the bread, you know, it's got a hard crust to it. So Kendra bought me a bread knife, and I've never really used a proper bread knife. So I've got the little thing here. She went to a store called Knifeware, which I think is a Canadian thing. I don't know. It's knifeware.com. I'm not getting any money off of them. This is not an ad. It's just one man's story. And I got a Tadafusa Hocho Kobo knife that allegedly are from the traditional center for tool and knife forging in the Niigata prefecture of Japan.
Damn.
It's a legit bread knife. It was a little investment. And I was like, wow, a knife. Cool. Thank you. I wasn't very jazzercised about this. I was like, gotcha. A knife. And then I opened the thing up. I held it in my hand and I was like, oh, dang, this is special. And I used it and I found myself smiling as I was cutting my loaf of bread. And this was a new experience for me. And I was like, oh my gosh, I am loving the act of slicing bread. I've never used anything in my hand that is this fucking sharp. This is crazy right now. I thought like I knew.
Through butter?
Exactly. Yes. It was
put smooth. Me in your body.
It was smooth. And like what with our other knife, you have to give it a lot of back and forth to get through the crust. Yeah. This one was like
sawing zing,
straight Whoa. Through. And then you look at the slice and it is smooth as like a glassy table. It is just clean. Whoa. And I think I remember looking at her and saying, I thought I knew what sharp was my whole life. I thought I knew what sharp was until this moment you have smashed my perception of what sharp is. And I didn't even know what I was missing until it got here in my life. And then because this is how my brain works, I sort of had a philosophical crisis of sorts where I thought, where else in my life do I think I'm at like 100% A plus, but I just have no idea. It's like my definition of love or trust or nervous system regulation or connection or joy or bliss or pleasure, where I'm like, what if there's a bread knife level of a Tadafusa Hocho Kobo level of all of that stuff that I am missing out on, but I don't even know it.
Like a secret 10X life.
Yes.
Whoa.
And this was 2-3 years ago. I'm still talking about it as one of the things I wanted to bring up because it made me realize how many little tiny parts of my life too, I'm doing things or I'm interacting with things or I own things that I don't actually love that don't light me up. Like another very small example of this is on the cutlery topic. My grandparents passed away and I sort of inherited their silverware, like their knives and forks and spoons. And so I had these in my van when I was doing my van trip. And I just, when I was home a couple months ago, I brought them up here and they're now in our, what do you call it? Knife drawer or whatever, cutlery drawer. Because before we just had plain old, I don't even know, IKEA knives, forks, and spoons. And like they worked fine. But now I've got these knife, forks, and spoon, and they have these like little metal engraving on them. So they look different. They feel different. And when I open the drawer and I see it, I'm reminded of my grandparents and I'm reminded of love and connection. And I'm reminded that like these things are more than just things because of the stories and the life that they've lived. And so now when I'm like using a knife and fork, I feel like I've had that elite 10X level. And so then I'm like starting to look around at other stuff. Like I bought this mug. You can't see it if you're listening, but I bought this coffee mug looking thing. It's a handmade ceramic one. And I glued this little gemstone where I put my thumb.
Oh, wow. You glued it yourself?
Yeah.
It's like a holder? Or you just wanted...
I used to have a mug that had this.
No kidding.
And then I broke the mug, but I saved the gemstone. And so now I'm like, I fucking love this mug. I love this fork that I use. I love my bread knife. And so the reason I'm sharing all this is essentially to get people thinking about, like, what are these little tiny upgrades that you can make that actually you use every single day?
Yeah.
That like make a difference. And so now I'm looking at like the plates we have. And I was like, I don't love this plate. Like, it's just a white plate. Like, what if I loved the plate that I put my bread and eggs on? You know, like, what would that feel like? I don't know. I've never had that, but I'm curious.
10x upgrade.
Yeah. Bread knife.
Yeah, man. I'll tell you the opposite story because I'm looking at it. I have it on my altar.
Dude, sorry. Do you have a good bread knife? Does Katie have one?
I don't have a good bread knife. But here's a little something we can talk about maybe. I had someone I dated like a decade ago buy me two really good Japanese knives. She was also teaching me to cook at the time. That's how we sort of got together. And they're sharp as fuck. And someone who I live with when we moved in together did the like, hey, we should use all of my stuff and put all of your stuff in the garage move. And including some knives. And someone who I live with, her knives aren't that sharp. And she's also not good at like, you know, doing the sharpening thing. I'm not really it's not like in her DNA. Like every time I grab a knife, I sharpen it and then I use it. And so to answer your question, I have brought my two Japanese knives back out of the garage and I use them and they're sharp as fuck. But the bread knife that we have is... It pales in comparison to the story that you told me. I do not have bread cutting chasms. I have like, oh, this is like a cheap table saw, a hacksaw. Let me spend half an hour and my immense amount of right-handed lat and bicep strength to cut through this soft, delicious, doughy piece of sourdough.
Yeah. Like I used to be annoyed. I'd get the sourdough and it's made and I'd be like, ugh. I have to cut it now. To use it. And now I'm like, oh, I get to cut it now. And it's actually a sincere thing. But you've reminded me that someone that I live with has a very sharp Japanese knife and is half Japanese. Yeah. And when we first moved in together, it's like one of the most beautiful knives I've ever seen. The blade is like this textured kind of stained glass.
Oh, yeah.
It's wavy and curvy. And I made a joke when we were moving in together of like, do I need to ask permission to use this knife? And someone I live with turned very seriously and said simply, yes. And I was like, and it was not a joking conversation. And so I've used that knife like twice in 5 years.
Do you use it when she's not home? You can tell us like,
no.
Okay. You just take it out and like hold it.
You've met my girlfriend.
You'll just get a text. She'll be like seven countries away. So what's happening in the drawer?
Yeah, she would know, man. She would know. And like, I think it's like a credit to her boundaries. Where until you just said that, I've never even considered it. It does not even cross my mind. But she loves it. And it's another example where when she gets that thing out, she becomes like a chef in the kitchen. Yeah. She's just on another level.
I hear you. So, Jer, I'm going to tell you, on my altar, which is like 5 feet from here, I have a broken fork. And it broke twice. It broke three times. Two times we super glued it together. And then the third time I was like, okay, it's time to retire. But it is my childhood fork. It's like from the cutlery set we had in my family, like... all of that got thrown out. And I remember grabbing a fork and be like, I'm keeping this. And I used it for, you know, I'm 47 years old. This was probably 2 years ago that it finally had to be retired. And it traveled with me everywhere. And if I was eating a special meal, like, okay, I'm going to make some delicious gluten-free pasta. Like I'm busting out the childhood fork. And it just made it all the better. So I feel you. I'm just a little heartbreaking the third time. I was like, okay, you're now on the altar.
I love that your special meal is delicious gluten-free pasta.
I grew up allergic to wheat.
Oh, that's right.
So from like age 5 to 28, I just couldn't eat pasta. Or if I did, it was like the shitty buckwheat that would, you know, it's just awful. So now that gluten-free is amazing. Yeah. I'm having like a resurgence of my 20s, you know, like all the pizza and pasta I didn't get to eat. Yeah. I'm eating it now.
You've got the non-alcoholic beers as well going.
Yeah. Gluten-free apple pie. Man, it's like, imagine not eating that stuff for decades and then being able to. It's pretty goddamn good.
And even worse than that, just watching people eat it and love it.
Forever.
Like, sir, would you like some dessert? We have a homemade apple pie.
Yeah.
Can't.
It shapes so much of my probably personality. Whereas I remember there was a time for probably 5 years, like, I wish we didn't have to eat food. I wish food was like not a thing for humans, that I could just take a pill and get my nutrients. I would just do that, which is rough, you know?
Yeah. Like now. The Jetsons. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Or like the Matrix, the slob or the slosh.
Wow. Whatever it was. So yeah. You were at that level of disdain for food.
Yeah. Cause it would, if I did eat a lot of stuff, I just get sick. So it was like, okay, here we go. Like, let's eat dinner and then feel like shit after. Or let's go to school and have the peanut butter and rice cakes and have everybody make fun of me until I got to be 190 pounds and know how to choke people. Yeah. Not laughing now, are we, motherfuckers? There's still a little bit of stuff in there, probably.
So your diet did shape you, though. Like, it gave you a bit of an edge?
Yeah, it just made, like, I was used to things being hard. I was used to not having pleasure. Like, it took me a while to grow into someone who could like accept pleasure in food and other, unless it was like, you know, getting drunk or having sex. It just, life wasn't pleasurable.
Yeah. That's wild, man. I remember I had Leanne Rimes on the podcast and she was talking about, I can't remember what she had. She had some body autoimmune, like psoriasis maybe.
Yeah, I think it was, right?
Like super painful. And she said for years and years, it hurt to be in her skin, like in her body. Yeah. I remember her saying something like, how do you learn to trust your body when your body is associated with pain?
Right.
It's like, oh, same for you. Like, how do you develop a relationship with food when food equals discomfort, pain, resentment? Like, that's a whole thing.
We can go down a wormhole, man. When I did an externship in acupuncture school, I worked at a pain clinic. And just to feel and see what chronic pain did to people was eye-opening. Just the weight of like every moment from the moment I get up to multiple times a night when I can't sleep, like my life just sucks. There's like a lead blanket on them. And if our job was to try to like take the lead blanket off for an hour, that was it. Like, can I make you feel okay for an hour? Fuck yeah, I won. I won the game. But it's absolutely brutality. Yeah. So many people are dealing with shit like that, that they don't get to get, you know, in Dewey's levels of like, is the world okay? Am I okay? What can I do? How well can I do it? I think most of the population's stuck in like, am I okay? Or is the world okay? Mm. And it's a privilege of massive scale to not have something that you're currently dealing with that's chronic yet, you know, knock on wood.
Yeah. All right, man. Do you have another one?
Yeah.
I actually knives and library books.
I have some to tally off of a knife and I'm not so I haven't given it to him yet, but I doubt he's going to listen to your podcast before I give it to him. But I had this made. You see this?
Whoa. Jesus.
Yeah. So for those who are just listening, this is a handmade hatchet.
It looks like an axe. It's beautiful. The wood is...
Yeah, the wood is hundreds of years old. So this is made by a guy named Dan Altavia. It's Bushkill Blades. And I had this made for Dewey as his 73rd birthday present.
Oh.
And I haven't had a chance to give it to him yet. So this... And the guy carved in the uncivilized symbol on the sheath. And this is a dude who... So for... maybe 20 years, I've been on and off an MMA forum. And it's just like guys talking about MMA and guys talking about fighting. And when I was fighting, it was like, you go there, you know, there were pro fighters on there. You get to talk to people. But there was another side of the forum, which was basically just dudes talking about random shit from politics to women to cars to to dude stuff. And one of them was a knife maker. And over the course of the 20 years, we communicated a couple times. And when I moved out here and wanted to get into knife making, I chatted with him and he would always do these like raffles on that forum. Like, hey, here's the knife. Who wants it? Like, anybody throw in 20 bucks. I'm going to pick a name out of the hat. And so he handmade that. And I think Dewey's going to appreciate it for a number of reasons, but one, the wood is like a couple hundred years old, the of the handle. And then two,
thing back up. Sorry to interrupt you.
It's okay. Can you see it?
Yeah. It just looks fucking cool, man. And right? You have your symbol carved into the, or burned into the leather.
Yeah. You put a little design around it.
It just looks, it looks like that, a piece of art.
Badass.
Yeah.
Right. All handmade. You can just feel it is weighty. Like this thing weighs, you know, 6-7 pounds.
Yeah.
I love the fact that it's just made by hand. Like I've made a knife before and it took me a weekend. And were it not for the instructor's help, it would have looked like someone who has seizures and a lot of head trauma made a knife. But it, he was like, come here, come over, have a seat on my lap, and would like fix it, you know, 20 times to make it look like it's an actual blade. So the idea that someone sat there and like pounded this thing out and then shaped the wood and then sharpened the knife and then handmade the sheath and then burned in the symbol. Like there's, you know, 20 hours, 30 hours of work into this thing. And I just appreciate that. I think especially how much of our lives and work now is over the internet or staring at a screen rather than like a hammer, an anvil, a piece of steel and elbow grease and some old school mastery. You know, like he showed me some of his earlier knives and they looked like my first knife. He's like, it'll take you a dozen before you're even proud of it at all. And that's okay. But that's a dozen weekends of, you know, of trying to make art out of steel. So yeah, I really love this thing. I was like debating, don't tell Dewey, if you're listening to this, pause right now. I was debating keeping it. I got it.
Too like, good.
This is awesome. Dewey will never know. I'll just write him a card.
I didn't think it would be this nice. Let's get him a gift certificate to Costco or something. Yeah. Happy birthday, bro.
Yeah.
Just wear it. Wear the hatchet around on your belt. You know, like
right. Next time I'm over at his house. Oh, this that's nothing. Don't worry about it.
No big deal. You just reminded me after I got this Tadafusa Hochokobo from knifeware.com.
Yeah.
Kendra said, oh, there's a documentary that they made about the creator or the, what
no
do you call
kidding.
It? Yeah. The blacksmith or whatever.
What's yeah.
And so this company went to Japan and went into the workshops of, I want to say 4 or 6 of the like, OG elder best of the best, like the guys, they're like in their 80s, you know, they've spent an entire lifetime doing this stuff,
doing the, one thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
The, like the Dewey Freeman of knife making. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they go to Japan and I was struck by what several of them in my recollection said something like, I just want to make one perfect knife before I die. And they are just still striving and improving and trying to get better after, you know, 6-7 decades.
Decades. Yeah.
Doing this full time. And they are just renowned as the top masters on the planet.
Yeah.
And it was really neat to just see their discipline and actually the workshops where they make it and like, oh, this is the dude. This guy. He's just the best in the world at this. And like, yeah.
You want to know something else random? I was at a wedding the other night and got connected with a guy who I know makes knives. Like his girlfriend told Katie, our partners need to meet. And I was chatting with him and he's like, yeah, there's this guy. He's a full-time coroner, but he's a part-time knife maker. But he's so good at it that he's booked out for like the next 6 years. And it's all of these weird kind of, it's he's like, he only deals with something random. Like, I want you to take a buffalo skull and make that into the handle and then use this exotic metal. And like, that's what he does. I was like, what a odd set of skills probably been a very applicable set of skills of like discipline, you know, attention to detail, a very sharp mind, you know, that apply to a coroner that would make you a really good knife maker that you wouldn't think about going into like coroner school. Like, I know what this will translate into. I'll be the most badass bladesmith.
It does. It sounds like a movie, man, of like
the right?
coroner / weapon creator. But it reminds me too of, was it Kill Bill, where she goes to Japan to find the master sword maker and he's like a chef or something. And she's like,
yeah, I think so.
Yeah. To kill a rat. And then they go up like into his attic or whatever. And there's all these beautiful Hattori Hanzo, I think was his name. And he's just like a genius at that.
Yeah. But do you think you're going to have like a secondary genius, Jer? You think like bread making is like, eventually you're going to be like, wow, he was such a good writer, but like his bread is now like served in, you know, royal gardens when world leaders meet. You think you'll have something like that?
It's interesting because I have considered the possibility of that, not necessarily for bread, but first of all, yeah, I mean, that would be cool. And there have been various people over the last couple of months that have told me or Kendra, because I've gifted it to people, like, hey, here's a loaf of bread. They've said, I will buy this from you. Can I buy one of these once a month? I'm sure you know that recipe that I gave Katie is legit. And
it's so good. It's so good. Yeah.
But I, you know, I used to be a scientist. I worked for the Australian government on the Great Barrier Reef. Like, I got paid to scuba dive. That was a completely different life. Sure. And now I live in Canada and I work in personal development and I have a podcast. And so for me, and I'm sure for you also, like, you were executive bodyguard, you were acupuncture guy, you were cage fighter guy. We all have these different chapters.
Sure.
And I'm intrigued by, you know, looking back 10, 15 years ago, how much I've changed and how much we've all changed. And then projecting that into the future, 10 or 15 years,
right?
Who might I be? And I started really thinking about this a lot after I read a book by Henry Shookman. And Henry, I heard about because he was on the Tim Ferriss podcast twice, recommended by Kevin Rose, actually, who those are the two guys that do the Random Show that inspired this conversation. And Henry Shookman is a Zen master. I think he's based in New Mexico. And he wrote a really cool autobiography, memoir about his life and like how he got to be this very well-regarded, renowned Zen master. Like, teaches people, has the whole location. And like, that dude was not a Zen master from day one. He was like a normal dude, had his issues, living a normal life, a series of odd coincidences. He follows his hunch, blah, blah, blah. Life happens. He's a world-renowned Zen master, meditation teacher. And so I was thinking about that in my own life of, I think I even told Kendra one day, what if I became a meditation Zen master? Like, that's possible. I went and did a Vipassana retreat last year, which is a 10-day sit, very difficult. But I had this moment that you just described of, like, what if that was my future? Or what if I started a bread company and that became my next chapter, so to speak? I don't know, but I think I'm open to the idea of it. I don't view my life in the way that those 80-year-old Japanese knife makers are like, this is my thing. I'm laser focused. I will do this until the day I die. I'm very much on the other side of the spectrum, actually, which is, does this still light me up? What's calling me in this direction? Like, do I want to be a pilot? Do I want to study massage? Do I want to be a painter? Like, I don't know.
Do you have like a kernel of a thought of what it could be? Besides, obviously, Elite Bread.
Besides Elite Bread.
That should be the name of your bread company, by the way.
Well, no. Do you want to know the name?
Tell me.
Picture this.
Okay. Hold on. Wait a minute. Let me get... All right. I'm ready.
Long distance loaf bombs.
Like a loaf of bread? I'm going to go with Elite Bread. I love your name. And yeah, I just
long-distance loaf bombs.
From a branding perspective, yeah.
If I just had like a tab on my website that said bread, like, here's my products.
It would be a curiosity for people that like go on your page or on your site and like what?
Yeah, what
bread? It's like knitting, you know.
But I don't. If I had to like make a wild guess, I don't even know. I feel like writing is perhaps my version of knife making. Like that has been a unifying skill from my science career. Even when I was like sort of a vagabond, adrift party guy, I still had a blog and I loved writing and sharing stories and sending emails home to family. And that's kind of the core thing that I really do enjoy. But the consequence of that is that it's directly applicable to any profession. Like you could do anything and use writing in some way to communicate, describe, sell, market, discuss. Like, so I don't know.
Just express.
Yeah.
Right. It's that I agree with you because it's a through line, but it also is, it's the secondary thing. You want to have an interesting life to write about.
Yes.
Or an interesting set of topics to write about rather than, so it's almost secondary to whatever else you decide to delve into.
Yeah. You know what? I'd be curious to hear your answer after I share this part, but my buddy Brendan, who you know, we walked across Spain together on the Camino that I lead. And the other day he and I were messaging just some silly back and forth of like, man, when we're 60, do you want to just meet in Spain and open a hostel and like on the Camino and just like run a hostel together? And like, man, that would be fun to just be like a hotel owner in Spain. Yeah. Just like living that life. So I don't know.
Do it. Yeah.
What about you? If you had to like predict a radical career shift or like identity in the next 5, 10 years, 20 years?
You know, it's such an odd thing to say because such an, like, as these things are, it's like a very hard deviation. And this is going to, it may sound super morbid, but two of the most impactful experiences of my life were one, volunteering in hospice for the year. So working with people who were dying, like that changed me. It rewired my insides. And it rewired every way I look at life since. And then second, being in the dark for the month, the period where I thought I had died. And that experience with death also rewired my insides. And so I have this tiny little kernel of a thought of like, I'll get back into hospice work, or I'll get back into speaking about, writing about, discussing how the idea of how someone's relationship with death informs their life. And I don't know where that comes from or where it goes, right? I'm about to write a book about the dark. And one of the big pieces of it is how it took my idea of death. And I've never had a near-death experience in the way that a lot of people have. Like, oh, I crashed my car, I left my body, I saw the surgeons, I heard the conversation, I came back into my body. I've never had that. But my relationship with it went from cognitive to somatic, like from thinking to like, okay, oh, I fucking get this on a different level after that year. And so I feel a tiny pull to that, of listening to interviews with people who have, you know, volunteered in hospice or worked in hospice for decades, or talking with Stephen Jenkinson is one of my, I've interviewed him like 3 or 4 times. And so I don't want to come on your podcast and be like, I think I'm going to get into death. Like that's going to be my thing after, you know, men's work and acupuncture. But I have a sense that I have a different perspective on it now, and I want to deepen that perspective. And there's some draw to that. There's a draw to that and a draw to myth, Jeremy. Like those two things, if you handed me $10 million right now and we're like, cool, you're retired, I'd be like, cool, I'm going to show up and still work at Uncivilized. I'm going to surf my brains out and I'm going to study myth and I'm going to volunteer with people who are dying. That's what I do with myself.
Do you currently volunteer?
I tried but COVID happened. And so there was a lot of obviously stuff put into place when COVID happened. Like when I was volunteering, they would stop us at the front door and be like, do you have a cold? Do you feel sick in any way? Do you have a fever? And be like, nope, I feel good. Like, okay, come on in. Because any little thing in a home with people of that that quality of illness or whatever they're dealing with, like the flu will wipe out an entire wing of a hospice center and kill 50 people, you know? So no, I haven't. And my life wasn't set up for it. You know, they're like, can you be here for a year? Because you don't want to be introduced to people and be like, cool, I'll be back in 6 weeks. Cool, I'll be back in 3 weeks. But it's something that sits with me in a very different way than it did prior.
Yeah, it's like that little heart whisper I talk.
Yeah.
There's something there.
And I feel like for the culture, like I'm able to do a lot of the things I do in the world because of that experience, because I get it. Like we are all going to end up there. And it's not this thought of like, someday I'll be done. You know, it's like, no, that's close to my consciousness. And I've also worked with people and said, the reason you're afraid to do this is because you haven't realized yet that you're going to die. That's why you're scared to write the book, ask the girl out, go on the trip, do the things. Like you don't get it, that thing is going to be here faster than you know. And that's what got put in my body from those two experiences.
Yeah. I remember in one of Stephen Jenkinson's book, he talks about giving a presentation and asking how many of you know that you're going to die. Like everybody raised their hands. And then his follow-up was something like, how do you really know? Like, you know, based on your decisions, how you spend your time, et cetera. And like when you actually embody mortality, it's a different life. I have a podcast I would recommend for you. I interviewed this guy called Jeremy Allen, or maybe have him on your podcast. I can intro you. He is a funeral home director and an embalmer of bodies. And he runs something called Grief Ed. Canadian, great dude. He's like, he's just a great human, and he's very open and very honest. And he told me this story about embalming his grandpa.
Oh, like
his own grandpa. And there's a long story around it, but he's very well versed and he's in the death space. I think he'd be a cool person to connect with.
Yeah.
Or you can just listen to my podcast.
Sure, sure, sure.
Jeremy Allen.
Yeah, send it to me, please.
How are we doing? How are you doing on time?
I got a little more time.
Are you
enjoying one more?
Yeah.
Thoroughly enjoying my time with you, Dr. Jeremy Goldberg.
Yeah. You know, when I had the idea, it sounded a little wacky. But because there's so much, man. Like, you know, we have podcasts and you talk about serious kind of topics and relationships and trauma and all the rest. And it's like, you know, I've really enjoyed listening to the Tim Ferriss ones where it's just a couple of dudes shooting the shit and it's very refreshing. And it's like, this is a nice like palate cleanser. Well, I've got three random things, but like the one that I've talked about this on Instagram quite a bit, which is what I call kitchen farming.
Okay.
Which is
never heard of this.
Your
sprouts.
Sprouts. Sprout life, bro. So I call it kitchen farming. I interviewed a guy called Doug Evans, who is like the sprout guru. He wrote a book called The Sprout Book. He has a long history as an entrepreneur. He's very well known, but he slid into my inbox one day and was like, can I mail you my book? And I was like, sure. And then he said, would you be open to doing an Instagram live one day with me to talk about this? And I said, no, I don't really like Instagram lives, but I'll take your book.
You know,
why don't you like Instagram lives?
I just don't love them, man. They just don't light me up. And like, this was a guy I had no interaction with. I didn't really know about him. And I was like, no, I'm not going to give you time. And I'm not going to like expose you to my audience. I don't fucking know you, man.
Yeah.
But long story short, time went by. We connected. I had him on the podcast, a full interview. Like, it worked out. But anyway, sprouting, I call it kitchen farming because it just feels like much cooler. And essentially, you buy seeds on the internet and then you put them in a jar. And there's a lid on the jar that has like a metallic or plastic screen. And you very simply, very easily, I have it in my dish rack, in 3 to 5 days, grow fresh broccoli, alfalfa, etc. sprouts in your kitchen. And it is super fun. You get to watch stuff grow. It's delicious. It's vegetables and like sprouts, because I read his sprout book. Sprouts are like one of the healthiest things you can eat, because they're like dense. They're packed with all the like good stuff that's been like enlivened from the seed, you know? So they're like really, really healthy.
Yeah.
And then you go to the store and buy them, and they're like expensive and they're kind of old and a little like limp. Yeah. Whereas this is like, I put it on everything, sandwiches and eggs and omelets. Like your breakfast, I would have just like dumped a bunch of sprouts on there. Then I feel like I got my vegetables. And it's easy. It's like 2 minutes a day. So I'm on the full on sprouting parade
train.
I'm on the train, man. I'm like the assistant.
How many different kinds of sprouts are you growing at the same time?
Well, I was talking.
Wow.
Glad you asked.
Hold the fuck on. You may want to sit down for this, people.
I was talking to Kendra the other day about that. I need to go and buy another jar. Like I have a big jar and I have a bunch of little jars, but I was saying to her, you know, if I had another big jar, then I could just be eating sprouts every day a lot. And so I don't know. I bought like 6 different kinds of sprouts from this website, and then they just arrive. And so I have like a cupboard that has a broccoli mix. So broccoli apparently is like very healthy. Warning, disclaimer, I'm a knucklehead. I'm not a health expert. Don't like trust what I'm saying here. But from what I've read, my understanding is sprouts and broccoli sprouts in particular are very good for you. There's something called sulforaphane that is this thing that's meant to be good. Anyway, there's a whole bunch. There's like a Middle Eastern blend that has a little bit of spice. There's like a radish mix that's like this beautiful pink color that has a bit of a kick. There's one that I really like. It's called the sandwich booster, I think. That's like, if you went to any deli, if you like went to the deli and there's like, they just put a pile of sprouts on your pastrami or whatever. It's like, it's that mix.
It's that. Okay.
Super good. Super easy. Like, you know, $30 upfront investment for like a jar and some seeds and like,
you're just sprouts for life.
Sprouts for life. It's one of those things where, much like a very sharp bread knife or a library card, to try to tie this all together randomly, where I think, you know, why didn't I do this years ago? Like this is just such an obvious win. I mean, why have I not been doing this for the last decade?
I'm going to get Katie on this.
Yeah, I'll message her.
Start sprouting.
I mean, I got her doing the bread. It's like
game changer,
dude. Let's not say Katie, by her own queen-like decision and agency, chose the sovereign path of bread making.
Yeah.
Via, you know, an invitation. I didn't make her do anything.
Sure.
But wait till you get like fresh sprouts. They're almost too crunchy, Traver. Wow. Where I'm used to the store-bought stuff.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's too fresh, these sprouts. Where is the older, like, craftier store-bought stuff?
Yeah. I think I'd put them in a smoothie.
Yeah.
Instead of my frozen spinach.
Anything. Yeah, whatever.
Love this.
God, you already see the potential.
So much impact and benefit and value into this random conversation.
I agree. This is fun. Like, we might have to do another one of these.
I'm definitely down. I wonder if the random shows should just be like, by purchase only. because there's so much value.
Send me the receipt to your sprouting jar and I'll send you the URL download
to the next one.
the secret random show.
People with sharp as fuck bread knives all over the world are your new audience.
Yeah. At some point we go long enough. It's like, how many downloads did your podcast have? And I was like, 4. It's like, yeah. Oh, Trevor and I spent 2 hours making that. So 4 people could hear us talk shit.
Brought to you by knives.com, sprouts.com, your local library, and Guinness.
Totally. I mean, so like Kendra and I have joked about, so when I first started Long Distance Love Bombs, I sold prints, magnets, like beer holders at farmers markets. And I love farmers markets so much. And there is part of me that's like, what if I just went and had a stand at the local farmers market and I sold some prints and I had a couple loaves of bread and I had some sprouts and like, I'm just jarring out, you know, every Saturday. I don't know.
Sell some books.
Oh yeah. Books.
You need to get Long Distance Love Bombs t-shirts. Do you have those?
You know what's funny, man? I don't have them. I've never had them. And I have a meeting. Well, I was supposed to have a meeting yesterday with our friend, our artist friend who, you know, who's blonde. You know what I'm talking about? I guess I could just say it. My friend Padilla.
Yeah. She's actually our nation speaker tomorrow.
No shit.
Yeah. She's coming to talk to the nation.
About what?
About the magician archetype.
Padilla.
Like, she's a magician. Padilla. Yeah. Like, wow. how do you make, like, I want a gnarly street artist to come in. And I was like, no punches pulled. Like, punch these guys right in the face with how bold you are and how you make art. Yeah.
Dude, I'm just learning about this.
Yeah.
What time's the call?
Do you know? Noon, I think, my time.
Okay.
Noon MST. Yeah.
But wait, so let me check. She's a genius. She's a genius. Truly. Like, I know I throw that word around sometimes haphazardly.
Yeah.
It's very overused. She is legitimately like an artistic genius.
Yeah.
Like, amongst the most creative people I've ever come across. Her backstory is insane.
Yeah.
About the trauma she experienced as a kid.
She's like Michael Jordan level of art.
She is on a different level entirely. I put very few people up at that space, and she's one. And is like so humble and such a cool person, but she really likes me. And I've said things to her like, hey, can you help me with X, Y, Z? And she is very, basically, long story short, we've been having a back and forth over the last 2 months. She got me on Pinterest to create a vision board.
Yeah.
She has a whole process that I have just been like dragged onto the ride, and we're going through it together. But stay tuned, because Long Distance Love Bombs merchandise will be
about to go next level.
Yeah. And I was like joking with her. I'm like, I want a freaking like a monocle. I want a cane. I want some like carrot peelers. Like, what do we do? Like, what can we do that's different? But I basically threw a little tantrum one day and said, you know, I'm tired of wearing all my friends' merch. Like, your merch is amazing. I wear it multiple times a week as an example. But one day I looked in the mirror and was like, why don't I have my own merch? Like, I have a brand. I have people.
I've got your print on my wall. It's like on the wall of my living room.
What am I doing? And then, but also, you know, I have a to-do list a mile long and I have no idea how to do that stuff. But she is a genius. So we'll see what comes of that. But
next level. Yeah. Tomorrow noon, MST. Hop on. Okay.
All right. All right. Do you have one more? Do you feel good calling it?
I feel good, man.
Okay.
Feel good.
Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me on. Thanks for listening, everybody.
And with you, man.
Yeah. It's cool. I like this format.
We'll see how it goes over. So if you're listening, give me some feedback. If on the scale of, you know, this was extraordinary, I love this, I listened to every word, versus what are you guys thinking? This is, don't ever do this again. It was nice, but you know, I admire you trying something new, but this just missed the mark. Anyway, but Trevor Boehm, Man Uncivilized podcast, manuncivilized.com, events, retreats,
book.
You're the best. Appreciate you.
Thank you, brother. Love you. Thanks for having me on.